and healthcare adherence to device reprocessing best practices is what we use to ensure patient safety. Clearly, one of our greatest threats is healthcare-associated infections, or HAIs. In the United States, it's estimated that one out of 25 patients contact at least one HAI during their hospital stay. That's nearly 5,000 patients a day and over 300 deaths each day.
Millions of patients undergo surgical procedures every single day. Working behind the scenes are the technicians who go largely unknown, even to the patients whose lives are so dramatically impacted by their work. This is Beyond Clean, the global voice of sterile processing. Join us as we explore this hidden world and introduce you to the unsung heroes driving the advancement of our profession. And now, your hosts, Hank Balch, Justin Poulin, and Michael Matthews. Beyond Clean.
This week on Beyond Clean, we speak with Chuck Hughes, principal and lead educator at High Power Validation and Testing Laboratories Incorporated. And now, as announced at the ISHM annual conference just a week and a half ago, joining us as an executive advisor here at Beyond Clean. Chuck Hughes is the retired founder of SPS Medical Supply Corp and has worked for 30 plus years in the manufacturing industry in areas of regulatory affairs, marketing, research and development, microbiology, and sterilization training. He's been a corporate member of APIC, AORN, AST, ISHM, OSAP, SGNA, and numerous other organizations, including AMI and CSA, where he contributed to writing medical device reprocessing standards. He's a popular speaker at regional, national, and international healthcare conferences, and Chuck has visited thousands of healthcare facilities, providing continuing educational training and mock surveys of medical device reprocessing areas. High Power Labs helps medical device manufacturers develop and validate IFUs that are reasonable for healthcare facilities to comply with. This service is provided for new devices and for existing devices that processing personnel have trouble complying with, i.e., your IFUs that are incomplete or that require unusual resources. And Hank, we're going to get into a lot of this topic with Chuck today on the show. But first, I do just want to say it was an awesome event. We had another panel discussion at ISHM. That's where we announced that Chuck would be joining us as an executive advisor to Beyond Clean. And then, of course, all of the listeners and fans that came up to the booth really was just flocking. The first day, there were three rows back of people at the booth. I got to tell you, I was actually surprised to some degree, but also really excited to see all the engagement and interest in the podcast.
That's right, Justin. It was a great opportunity for us to finally meet all of these folks who have been loyal listeners from the very beginning, you know, season one. We had folks come and say all kinds of things. We had one manager come and tell us that he requires his staff to listen to Beyond Clean podcasts every week. There's one lady who stopped by to say she got into the industry because somehow she came across a Beyond Clean episode and started listening and said, I want to be in that industry because there's passion there. And humbling experience, obviously exciting as well, but to see that in person and know all the work that we do on the back end to get these stories told and become a voice and an advocate for a profession that has been oftentimes degraded or ignored, you know, now finally we have a platform to say, no, we matter. And not only do we matter, but there's a way forward for us to lead healthcare in a safer direction. Awesome myth-busting event, like you said as well. Great to meet the fans. And I'm really looking forward, though, to this interview with Chuck to give him a platform and really tell the awesome expertise that he has to our listening audience.
HealthMark has intelligent solutions for your cleaning verification program, including products to measure water temperature, water quality, cleaning efficacy, and directly test for residual soil left on instruments. Find your tools for cleaning verification at hmark.com. There you will learn about our TOSI and SonoCheck that test the performance of mechanical washers as recommended in sterilization standards guidelines. Other products like CartWash Check test for mechanical efficiency and target temperature. The ProCheck 2 can detect residual protein to a very low level. Go to hmark.com today for all of your cleaning verification testing needs. It's 2023 and there's big news for IST. A closed warning letter, a new product launch, and a 10-year anniversary. OneTray IST has a lot to celebrate this year. OneTray's 2006 cleared 48-hour storage claim was acknowledged by the FDA, and the company is pushing forward, offering the total solution for reprocessing. OneTray maximizes reprocessing time. EasyTrax adds flexibility with instrument organization, and their upcoming product, OneCart, a sealed case cart with a smaller footprint and a perfect option for offsite sterilization, completes the total solution. Experience a year of efficiency with OneTray. For more information on the closure of the warning letter, visit OneTray.com/FDA warning letter. That's OneTray.com/FDA warning letter. Otherwise, you can reach out to the company by calling 937-619-0138 or visit OneTray.com/contact.
Beyond Clean. Joining us now is Chuck Hughes, principal and lead educator at High Power Validation and Testing Laboratories and also executive advisor at Beyond Clean. Chuck, I know we made the announcement at Isham, but we're really happy to have you on the team. And today's episode talking about standards, recommendations, and guidelines is going to be a can't miss for our listeners.
Well, thank you, Justin. I'm happy and proud to offer my assistance as the executive advisor to the Beyond Clean team. I've been a big fan of Beyond Clean podcast for all four seasons here.
Excellent. Well, here we go. We'll get right into it. And talking about standards, recommendations, and guidelines, let's distinguish between the difference with each of those and just make sure that all the listeners kind of understand before we take a deeper dive into each of these areas.
I always think of a standard as a criteria set for a certain task, and they definitely differ from recommendations or guidelines in that they carry greater incentive for more universal compliance. So here in the U.S., when we think of AAMI standards, they represent a national consensus, and whereas you think a recommendation is more of a statement of practice, such as what ARN guidelines do and their recommendations, or even a guideline itself, we think of that as a statement of advice or instructions pertaining to a practice, and the CDC comes to mind as the most obvious one that established those types of guidelines.
So, Chuck, can you explain some of the common misconceptions or misunderstandings that are related to each of the, you know, the standards, recommendation, and guidelines and the differences between?
Well, I think the obvious misunderstanding that I've seen throughout my career is where healthcare professionals think of whether it's a standard, a recommendation, or a guideline, they all represent best practice. And these best practice documents, as I like to describe them, many times are seen as helpful, but not really all that important. You know, there's no one holding a gun to your head saying you absolutely have to do these types of things. In fact, unfortunately, what I've found, I'm sure, Justin, you have too, and many in the audience, is that everybody in healthcare, I've found, cares, but some people seem to only care up to the point that it inconveniences them. And surely these documents are inconvenient for healthcare facilities and personnel at times. But surveyors, they certainly are expecting compliance with these documents because they really should be the basis of the healthcare facilities, policies, and procedures.
Now, apart from the surveyors, and I know you mentioned they're inconvenient, but why are they so important in the big picture for compliance in light of these different standards, recommendations, and guidelines?
Well, best practice compliance really should be adhered to in any profession because they reflect the values of that profession. in healthcare, adherence to device reprocessing best practices is what we use to ensure patient safety. Clearly, one of our greatest threats is healthcare-associated infections, or HAIs. In the United States, it's estimated that one out of 25 patients contact at least one HAI during their hospital stay. That's nearly 5,000 patients a day and over 300 deaths each day. So while I'm not saying that improperly reprocessed medical devices is a leading cause of HAIs, it certainly has been documented by the CDC along with our national media as one of the causes. So some of the listeners who've heard me speak over the years have heard me say this numerous times, and let me reiterate it. For these reasons, we really must do everything possible to reduce healthcare-associated infections, which in my mind means compliance with these documents, these best practice documents, not some of the time, not most of the time, but all of the time.
And Chuck, I know you've been very much involved in a lot of the meetings around the development of these guidelines, and I know a lot of times people don't realize, and especially from our listening audience, that they can become part of that. And I know that they really want to encourage participation from healthcare and specifically the end users. And I know sometimes that might be difficult due to travel, but I think another reason why is people don't know what to expect. There may be apprehension of walking into a room where there's a number of committees that are forming and they don't know anybody. And so it may just be intimidating to go there for the first time. I thought maybe you could describe what that environment is like. I'm thinking specifically of AAMI, but I understand that's not the only organization. But maybe you could talk a little bit about what that's like and what somebody who might want to get involved could expect if they attended a meeting and participated on a committee.
Sure. And it would be my advice, if you were going to choose a working group committee to get involved with, AAMI would be a marvelous place to start. They've recently moved all of their meeting rooms from hotels to their AAMI headquarters this last go around. So you have an opportunity to come to Washington, D.C. in the spring as well as in the fall and participate in various working groups. We've always been very welcoming to users in particular, and whether you're an industry expert or whether you're a user or a consultant or a laboratory staff person, it's highly recommended that you come and participate. There's many folks such as myself. I'm originally from the South, so my Southern hospitality always kicks in for new people coming and love to introduce you, make you feel warm, make you feel welcome. And we certainly want to do that. I think the most important thing, though, is to come prepared. If there's something very specific that you have in mind, such as you're dealing with low temperature sterilization and the document of ST58 has a very specific working group and you'll want to attend that working group committee. Or if you're just want to cover, the steam sterilization working group, ST40, well, that's the ST79 document, but it has a different working group. So you want to be aware that these various documents that you want to have different working groups, and those are the ones that you want to attend. And if you can't come in person, we now have remote access to the AAMI meetings that officially started this last go-around here this past fall, and that's an exciting opportunity for people to sit in and listen and contribute as well.
Chuck, I want to go back to the topic of misconceptions again, and a number of our audience are frontline technicians, frontline leaders, managers of sterile processing departments, and as they come into this question of standards and guidelines, the most well-known one are those AAMI ST79 guidelines. But if you were to build a package of all of the pertinent standards, I won't say all, the most important ones that you think every department leader should have their hands on, if it's a guideline recommendation, what would you put in that bucket to make sure that folks get started on the right foot in really leading their departments well?
Great question. And while AAMI does offer bundles of some of these documents into large books, the ones you really want to zero in my mind is those you are doing steam sterilization ST79. That goes without saying. But also in some cases, we see healthcare facilities using dry heat sterilization. That would be ST40. Or those who are continuing to use EO sterilization. There's a kind of resurgence of EO sterilization, particularly when you start looking at some of the extended reprocessing for Duodenoscope. And that would be AAMI ST41 for EO sterilization. And moving right into a document such as ST58, I mentioned it, and the act for low temperature, but the actual title is chemical sterilization and high level disinfection. And let's not forget flexible and semi-rigid endoscope processing. That has its own document now. That's AMES T91. So those are the most obvious AMI documents that you want to be involved with. But at the same time, those of you working in the operating room, you know, each year the annual ARN guidelines for perioperative practice is very important. Or if you're an offsite facility, a medical or dental facility, the CDC medical guidelines, the CDC dental guidelines, along with SG&A, you know, is the third one that for reprocessing flexible gastrointestinal endoscopes. And the CDC medical, dental, and SG&A, Mike, I want to mention to you, are free. Those are the ones you can go to their websites, cdc.gov and sgna.org. And those particular documents can be downloaded free of charge. I wish ARN was, and I wish the AMI were, but that's just not the case. But by all means, those are those obvious documents, depending on where you're reprocessing and what you're reprocessing, that come to my mind.
Now, I know we do have some AMI listeners out there. So guys, if you ever want to change your pricing model to make some of these resources a little more affordable, because I know as a sterile processing manager, our budgets are small to begin with. And if you start looking at some of the pricings for these, you should never be priced out of best practice or of industry standards, you know, but in some cases you are. So we're going to get there tomorrow, but I think that is a direction that we should encourage our entire industry to go. I did want to follow up one more time on the AMI documents and get a little into the weeds. I was wondering if you could talk about the confusion or maybe clarify a little bit of the debate around should and shall in regards to the AMI language. So what, as a user, how should we understand the differences between those two words, should and shall?
Well, AMI tries to describe that as simple as they can, but there's always a lot of confusion about that. And it really comes down to how they try to explain compliance with the standard, not a shall as in it's state law or Department of Health is saying you shall do this, but it all comes down to adherence and compliance with the specific standard that they're describing. And so there's the shoulds and there's the shalls. And I like to say, you know, if you wake up on the right side of the bed or the wrong side of the bed, maybe sometime if you just feel like it. But, you know, in my mind, you know, when it comes to writing policy and procedures and using these documents as your resource and expecting your surveyors to hold you in compliance with those, they all become shalls at that point, or they all become shalls from a patient safety standpoint, or the third motivation that's only occurred in recent years, maybe not so recent, but certainly in the last 8 to 10 years, the national media attention. You know, if you're doing something that you think you should do, or maybe you're going to skip over something that's a should versus a shall, but you have a bad outcome, and then all of a sudden your healthcare facility is written up in the national news, I think everyone from the CEO on down would have preferred that you had made that a shall in your policy and procedure.
Hey, Chuck, you've already mentioned several different sources of these guidelines and policies. You know, we've mentioned AMI, AORN, CDC. You know, we've mentioned a lot of different sources, and they don't always necessarily agree. And one place we often kind of see this is, you know, the OR tends to follow AORN, sterile processing follows AMI. And if those two don't necessarily agree on a specific issue, who wins? And so when you're going through these kinds of these guidelines, how do you sort through the contradictions?
Yeah, another good question. I think that it's something that every healthcare facility struggles with, but knowledge is power. And I think many, many times, while ARN guidelines, for example, might be carte blanche with amongst the OR, they won't give all the in-depth information that maybe an AMI standard would do. So I think it really comes down to a decision that the healthcare facility has to make in writing that policy and procedure so that they can provide the guidance to the staff. And again, where you have more complete guidance from one document versus the other. I mean, they're designed many times to be used in combination of each other. There's nothing wrong with that, you know. And sometimes when I move outside of the United States and go to Canada, for example, sometimes they'll have additional information. It can be real subtle. For example, instead of IFU for instructions for use, they use the word MIFU or MIFU, and they use the word manufacturers in front of it. And so you're always talking about miss you. But regardless of the term used, the information, what's critical to healthcare facilities is before they purchase, borrow, or trial a new reusable medical device, that they have these documents available so that the staff know how to safely reprocess the device. I mean, without this information, let's face it, the user, they have to guess, which certainly could lead to breaches with device processing. We know that, unfortunately, breaches do and have occurred, and they've been reported in both local and national news. Literally thousands of patients have been contacted by healthcare facilities and having to be tested for possible hepatitis or HIV infections. In some cases, both patients and staff were reported to be infected. So this is serious, serious stuff. So having a policy and procedure in place for your facility that you feel is complete, accurate, and presentable, what I like to say, CAP, you want to CAP your work, make sure that everything is complete, it's accurate, and presentable, is really the way to go. And unfortunately, I'm not able to contribute to a lot of these other guidelines, such as CDC and ARN, but we're very much involved as industry and users and consultants, manufacturers with the AAMI standards. And those are the guidelines or recommendations that become adopted by ANSI, American National Standards Institute, as our standard. And as I mentioned earlier, the standard really sets criteria for a very certain task, and it does differ from recommendations or guidelines in that they have greater incentive and more universal compliance. So think of it that way, if that's helpful at all to the listeners.
Yeah, I really like the CAP acronym. And you mentioned all of this information getting out into the news, and it's really unfortunate. It's unfortunate to have to contact those patients. You know, it's unfortunate that, you know, the hospital systems and hospitals are in the news. But then on the other hand, it's really calling attention to the industry, which has not gotten a lot of public attention in the past, and I think it can really help push things forward. So, you know, it may have a positive outcome in the end that we're really shining a light on this industry. I know you've been working in this a long time, and I thought maybe you could share some common errors that you've noticed when reprocessing complex instruments, and maybe let's start with stainless steel surgical instruments.
Yeah, that'd be a great place to start. When you start looking at surgical instruments using the OR, you know, you think of point of use and then reprocessing area and then sterile storage. And over the years, I've reported both under contract and as a courtesy audits, literally thousands of healthcare facilities. And a lot of it, you know, you see repetitiveness. For example, point of use and at transport, you know, failure to wipe off the gross soil and or flush lumens with sterile water, and that seems to be a common thing, or delay in transporting the soiled items to the decontamination area. And of course, if there's going to be any delay at all, then you want to use a pre-soak solution. But again, a failure to use a pre-soak solution on soiled items prior to transport, that's a fairly common error we see. Transporting items without using a closed container or without using a biohazard symbol, fairly basic things that should be understood, that's not always understood. And Mike, I think in terms of that, a lot of facilities are practicing what I call common practice, and they have to be careful that just because it's what they've always done or what they've seen at other facilities does not make it best practice. Many times I've had to inform and educate folks that their common practice is not best practice. And especially when you get down to the decontam area and you see that they're not donning or doffing their PPE properly, more doffing, more of the removal of the PPE, more so these days than the donning. But back in the day, we had trouble with people wearing proper PPE, and certainly a continued challenge now getting them to remove it properly. Not having enough sinks so they could soak, they could wash, they can rinse. A lot of these IFUs or these MIFUs these days start off with a long soak time, and you have to have enough sinks to be able to do this. And of course, that comes from the manufacturer's written IFUs. And what if you don't have them? Or what if you're just not following them? These are all issues. Not using an ultrasonic cleaner properly, for example, not changing the water after each cycle, which is a new update in AAMI ST79, or if they have extended cleaning times. You know, here in the U.S., the vast majority of ultrasonic cleaners come to a decontam site of a healthcare facility with a preset cycle of, say, 5 or 6 minutes. But what about that device that has a 10-minute or 15-minute setting? I mean, you have to be aware of that. In fact, I can think of one product, an orthopedic instrument like Zimmer. I mean, let's take a look at that IFU real quickly. Number one, completely submerged the instrument in enzyme solution, allowed to soak for 20 minutes. There's the soaking. There's information about what specific type of detergent to use. Step two, rinse in tap water for a minimum of 3 minutes. There's information on the quality of water that's needed. Fortunately, only tap water, not an issue. Step three, ultrasonic clean for 10 minutes. So someone's got to know to reset the ultrasonic. Step four is rinse in purified water for at least 3 minutes. Oh, now we realize that we have some treated water that's necessary. Listen to this. Step five, repeat the sonication and rinse steps. That's another 10 minutes and another 3 minutes, and then remove excess moisture. So these are the kinds of things in the reprocessing area, specifically the decontam, that's really a challenge for them. You know, moving on the clean side, the prep and pack, some obvious ones are they're inspecting some of the instruments, but not all the instruments. And then that comes down to time, a lot of cases, or not using inspection lamps or lenses, or not cleaning instruments, or they are cleaning instruments or rigid containers on the clean side. And I can't tell you how many times I've stopped techs and said, are you cleaning here on the clean side? And said, well, instrument's got to be clean before it's packaged. So rather than take that instrument back through the pass-through window or set up a large enough facility where these rigid containers can be all done in decontam, there's a lot of shortcuts being taken there. And again, maybe they see that as common practice, but it certainly is not best practice. And trays exceeding 25-pound weight limit here in the U.S. is 25, in Canada is 22. I mean, again, these are common there. And then last but not least, and I think of sterilization and storage, of improper loading of the sterilizers or improper loading of the process challenge device. I can't tell you how many times people say, well, I ran a biological. In fact, I ran it in every load. We're above the standard. So, yeah, but you didn't run it properly. Or using an incorrect sterilization mode, such as they're using pre-vacuum, since they're so used to using steam pre-vacuum, but they didn't realize the IFU called out gravity for this particular type of device, like a breast sizer or something. Or changing the parameters. They think they have nothing exceeds 10 minutes, so they elevated to 10 minutes. And what about those devices that were supposed to be ran for 4? Are you damaging them? What about that device over here that's supposed to be ran for 15? You didn't capture that. So these are the kinds of things that are challenging, along with the dust and other contamination in sterile storage areas or stacking heavy wrap trays. It just kind of go on and on and on. In a typical mock survey or a facility audit that I used to do back in the day, anywhere from 75 to 150 non-compliance observations I would observe, zero in on a particular healthcare facility.
Yeah, you got to think if there's over 100 steps to properly processing a flexible endoscope, which we'll talk about here in a second, if there's that many steps for one device and you look at all of the processes over an entire department, there is a lot of opportunity to miss steps. And as those missteps add up, obviously that's where that risk increases. I wanted to go back real quickly to the example that you were using for the decontamination of the loaner tray, and you focused on the different types of water quality and the different steps there with ultrasonication, which is huge. I also like to tell folks, you know, look at how many different timing functions go into that. 3 minutes here, 60 seconds here, and again for 5 minutes. Now, you have a timer on the ultrasonic, but is there a timer at your sink side so that you know that you've been actively rinsing for 3 minutes? Is there a exactly. clock around the corner on the back wall? Is your staff walking back, you know, to start that timer? It's just not good enough to assume that I've been standing here, you know, doing this for 3 minutes or for 2 minutes, whatever it is. So those are important takeaways, even in beginning that process, to say what settings do we need, what equipment do we need, even if it's a digital timer or two or three, because you could have multiple trays going at once. So the complexities there are huge, but I do want to follow up. So you talked a lot about surgical instruments. What are some of the similar common errors that you see on the flexible scope side of things?
For many, many years, I would spend all my time on the surgical side, and I'd say the last 5 or 6 years, I was doing audits of healthcare facilities. It became obvious that somebody at the C-suite would call down and say, if he has time, could he visit Endo? So it was only the last 5 or 6 years of doing audits that I started spending time in endoscopy. And I'll be honest with you, I knew we had challenges in sterile processing, but getting over to Endo and seeing the challenges there, I realized that it also has its iceberg of issues. And so fortunately today, SG&A and ARN and AME have all these wonderful documents that call out the basic steps. There's 9 basic steps for reprocessing protocol we use for flexible endoscopes, you know, pre-cleaning and leak testing and manual cleaning and rinsing and cleaning and visual inspection. And I'm glad we finally got that in there. It took a while. High-level disinfection, whether it's manual or automated, rinsing with a high-level disinfectant and then drying and then storage. But starting at point of use, again, right in the procedure room, you know, not wearing proper PPE, or not having the manufacturer's instructions for use. These are 2 very common things that you'll see if you visit enough facilities. What about if there's reprocessing delays, especially if there's multiple procedures or with procedures performed at night or a weekend? Failure to clean all channels, even if unused. You know, fluid and debris can enter these channels at the distal tip and then transporting without using a closed container or not labeled with biohazard lid. These are similar to on the surgical side, but more common there too. When you look at leak testing, again, not having the manufacturer's IFU available, fairly common. Use of damaged water-resistant cap. I found that to be the case, or overlooking pressurization of a scope prior to immersion, these types of things. Not following the manufacturer's IFUs for reprocessing a damaged scope. In the manual cleaning and the rinsing stages, you know, failure to submerge, fully submerge the endoscope. People would submerge a scope, but we forget the word fully. It's kind of like cleaning. I always like to use the word thoroughly anytime I use the word clean. And the same thing with submerging scopes, fully submerging. So failure to submerge for the required length of time, that goes back to not having those timers available or not even knowing if there was a specific amount of time. You know, sometimes neglecting to dilute the detergent per the manufacturer's IFU, using worn, damaged, or even improper brushes. We saw that a fair amount of time. Failure to thoroughly rinse off soil and or detergent residue. Again, if you're going to use the word rinse, use the word thoroughly in front of that. And when you start doing the manual high-level disinfection and rinsing using a sink or a basin of insufficient size, again, maybe using a solution after its expiration date. Saw that a number of times, you know, not remembering to do the MRC testing prior to each use, you know, failure to dry all channels. And with an AER, probably the most common thing is just failure to manually clean and rinse the channels prior to placing in the AER, even if it's a device or an AER, the newer ones out that where they've gotten FDA clearance, it's not required. It's still considered best practice to go through and manually clean and rinse those channels prior to placing inside. And lastly would be storage. You know, we saw a lot of oversight in removing all the valves and the water-resistant cap when storing or neglecting to ensure that the scopes were hung with all locks in the free position or just crowding. There's always an issue of crowding and unsecured scope storage areas. These are some of the main ones I say that I saw over the years, and I'm sure current auditors or current surveyors are seeing them as well.
Chuck, this was a fantastic interview. Time flew by really fast, and I know that we're going to have you on again for future episodes, but I wanted to thank you not only for coming on the show today, but for serving in an executive advisory capacity to Beyond Clean. We've got big things planned for the coming year, and you're a big part of that, and so we're just really happy to have you on board.
Well, thank you very much. It's been my pleasure, and I look forward to assisting you folks in any way possible.
That was Chuck Hughes, principal and lead educator at High Power Validation and Testing Laboratories and executive advisor here at Beyond Clean, talking about reprocessing reusable medical devices. And really, I think we could do so many shows on standards, recommendations, and guidelines. I know he gave a few of his favorites, plus some stories. And honestly, there's a lot out there. There's a lot to learn. And I think even Mike, you and Hank and Bob, we all probably heard something from Chuck in this interview that we weren't aware of before, that, you know, were any of us still leading a department would have said, oh man, I wish I knew about that one. And that's why this show and continuing education is so important.
Absolutely, Justin. We've talked about many times how no one person knows it all. And, you know, every time I talk to somebody like Chuck, who has been in the industry for a long time and knows a lot, about the different standards, the recommendations, the IFUs, all those things, I always learn something. You know, they always tell me something that I didn't know before, and I walk away saying, "Man, I wish I had known that back when I was a manager. I could have done things differently." And so there was a lot of great information in this interview. In some instances, it was almost like drinking from a fire hydrant. There was so much good information. So great job by Chuck. Great interview.
All right, well, that's going to do it for this week's show. As a reminder, you can help support us by subscribing to Beyond Clean on iTunes or Stitcher, and now also on Google Play and Spotify. Simply search for Beyond Clean Podcast. We'd certainly appreciate a rating and a review because your feedback is important to the show. And if you have any topics that you'd like us to cover on a future episode, or if you'd like to share a picture anonymously on our Instagram page, just send an email to info@beyondclean.net. And on behalf of Hank, Mike, Chuck, and myself, thank you for listening to another edition of Beyond Clean.